part of the conversation. Send us a WhatsApp message on +27 73 470 3520 or call us at +27 12 001 7679. Let your voice be heard. Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media, from broadcast to baptism.
Well, good evening to you, and welcome to the Thursday edition of Business Sense right here on Adventist World Radio. We are powered by SID Media. If you've just joined us, welcome. My name is Thapelo Moloi, and across all social media platforms, it is at @Thapelo_MoloiSA. That's definitely where you can find me. It is a Thursday. That means it is Shapeshifter Thursday. I know for a fact that this is one of our biggest segments on the show. So we appreciate each and every one of you that continues to join us on this particular segment. And today is no different at all. We've got a big name today. So I hope that by the end of this particular conversation, you would have been encouraged a little bit. If you are looking at giving up, no. We don't have time to do that, right? And my shapeshifter this evening is Sandile Zungu, a seasoned businessman and entrepreneur, the founder and chairman of Zungu Investment Company, or ZICO, as it were. Not only is he an astute businessman, he is also recognized and honored with accolades in academia, and he is also the president and owner of AmaZulu Football Club, and he's joining us this evening. Buti, welcome to the show.
And thank you so much, Thapelo, for having me here. And good day to your listeners.
Ah, fantastic. How's the year end for you as, I suppose, a person? Because some people have been saying that year end fatigue is starting to kick in. Is it the same with you?
Well, I'm not fatigued, I must be very honest. I'm one person who believes in just giving it the next shift, changing gear as people wear down. I raise the gear. Right now I feel very energized. And it just so happens that many things are going according to plan. And when that happens, fatigue inspired by disenchantment has not set in, because I've put noodles into.
So things are going the way they should be going.
They are going the way they should. I mean, there have been years where things have not gone at all according to plan. And therefore, one needs to be able to contextualize and actually concede that when things are going well, they're going well.
Oh, lovely, lovely. And for young people, I know we're digressing a little bit, but for young people, what would you give them as a mechanism to deal with year end? I know young people are writing exams, for example. Some are just studying in their careers and they need to just push one last time for the last month of the year or thereabouts. What's your secret?
You know, mine is philosophical. Mine is philosophical. I belong to a generation that inherited freedom. The generation of Madiba fought very hard for our freedom. I'm simplifying things, of course. I mean, we were also in the sharp edge of the struggle for freedom. But essentially, our generation inherited freedom. We've got to work damn hard to protect it. And as far as I'm concerned, there's no holiday. There's no holiday. We've got no reason to be fatigued. We've got no reason to slow down and claim tiredness. That's my philosophical view. And therefore, even when I feel dejected, sometimes when I feel I'm too full up and say, look, you know, I've done enough. And by then say, look, you know what? Our generation has got a mission, which means we must work triple harder. And therefore, to young people, I always say, what is your mission? Can you really afford to say, I'm tired now. I just need to, I can only look forward to the festive season. What have you achieved to really feel entitled to just a good
season.
Time?
Yes.
And most likely we have not achieved much as a people. We have not achieved, if you're a young person, most likely you have not achieved much. Yes, you've got a reason to pause and say, "Whew, one mission accomplished. I've finished my exams."
Yes,
but don't pause for too long.
Don't
relax for too long.
Yeah,
as if you have accomplished much.
Yeah,
you've just done what ought to be done.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's really my philosophy to say, look, you know, our generation has got no reason to be over exuberant about things we've accomplished. We've not accomplished much.
Okay, that's amazing. I think it's philosophical. I appreciate that, but it's really good advice that one can, you know, implement, operationalize. Be intentional about what you're doing, so that when you take the rest, you rest, but don't rest too long, so that you can then start achieving the next set of things. Okay, I want us to go back, Baba, and tell us a little bit about yourself. Where you grew up, what were the some of the situations, like you said, you are a generation, you know, Yabu Madiba and all that. But I know you were born in Umlazi. How was that?
You know, for an African person, to just refer to Umlazi is not complete.
Okay.
To say I'm a Soweto is not complete. Nobody's grandparents or ancestors originally from Soweto.
Yeah.
Soweto is a new township.
Yes.
Umlazi, yes, that's where I was born.
Okay.
But I always trace my roots to the north of Tugela River, KwaZulu.
KwaZulu.
KwaHlabisa.
Yes.
That's where the umbilical cords of my forebears lie buried.
Yeah.
That's where my ancestral home is.
Yeah.
Yes, my mom and my dad migrated to the city.
Mm.
That's where I was born. The city of the township of Umlazi has always been a working class township.
Okay.
It was created for people who work in Durban.
Yeah.
And there were teachers, there were nurses, civil servants, there were policemen, and there were magistrates, people who were really there to enforce the rule of law, as it were.
Yeah.
There was an odd doctor here and there. There was an odd business person, but it was mainly general dealers.
Mm.
And the social ills that we know about our townships, where Umlazi was no different. You still had child molestation.
Yes.
You still had stabbings on weekends. You still had abuse of alcohol. Mm. Yes, things have become a lot more sinister.
Yes.
And a lot of criminality has become a lot more organized.
Sure.
Criminals are a lot more daring, and the sort of things that the extent they go to traumatize the communities are different to my time. During my time, I would say I could proudly say I'm an Umlazi boy. If I was scholastic, my township would conspire to just clear the path for me to pursue my scholastic endeavors. And only if I choose a Zotzi lifestyle would I then meet my equals. So you could choose your lane and stick to your lane. And by and large, you could reach the pinnacle of your life.
Yes. Okay. All right. I think you've touched on a few socioeconomic challenges there, child molestations, I suppose, poverty and all those sort of stuff. At a younger age, were these things that were observable to you, or at what stage did you start becoming aware of these social ills?
I became aware of them very young.
Okay.
I just remember I was possibly maybe 7, maybe 8.
Yeah.
When one of the younger men that we trusted, asked one of our guys I actually asked us to accompany him, you know, through the forest to the other side of the township. And we became, you know, our sixth sense, at least two of us said, let's not follow this man. I think our parents will actually object. And one of the guys, my peer, must have been 7 years, eight years maybe.
Yeah.
One of my peers, you know, followed the man. And when he came back, he had signs of, you know, being sodomized. And nowadays you'll actually think so sodomization and abuse of children is a nowadays thing. It was there.
It was there.
I was aware in my very young age that actually be careful, watch out.
Sure.
Don't trust people willy nilly just because they're elders. They're called buddy or uncle, whatever.
Yeah.
My parents, my family rules were such that you couldn't do certain things unless they specifically and approved. Yes, I mean the stabbings on weekends were a common feature. I know people get drunk on Sundays around 3-4 o'clock when they are moving from taverns or from drinking spots to where they live. They'll be carrying knives and they'll be fighting and they'll be causing havoc along the way. So the issues of stabbings were possibly the most violent that we got to experience. And there were gangsters even during those days. There were people who were specializing in car thefts. There was no hijackings.
Yeah.
It was mainly someone walks into a yard and breaks into a car in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And with a screwdriver, remove your car, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But they still feared being seen. You know. And so those kind of things, I mean, the theft was common. People would break into people's houses. Those days, they'll actually, you know, if you have pre-cooked meat or food, they'll steal your food and eat it. So you could actually, you'll swear that they were inspired by maybe some of them hunger.
Yes.
And they were not choosing to be criminals for criminal sake.
Yes, okay.
And nowadays people choose. That's my profession.
Yeah. Oof,
I'm having said that, I'm not a sociologist at all. So these are just my rudimentary observations.
Yes.
I mean, someone may actually write and make a much more compelling and convincing argument about then and now.
You. I hear you, definitely. And thanks for that, for that background. In short, what I'm trying to get at is how that has influenced, I suppose, the person that you now became, you know, running a football club, for example, running your own investment company and all that. That background as a child, did it ever at some stage, as you look back with retrospect and say, that played a role into who you became eventually?
In many ways than one. I think I owe my being to my village.
Yes.
Umlaz was my village.
Yeah.
When we say in the African idiom, the village raises a child. And I'm no exception. So a lot of things that I experienced during my formative years will have shaped my orientation today. But it also helped that I came from a very strong family.
Strong family. Yeah.
I was lucky to have parents who were both involved in our upbringing. What limited my parents' involvement, you know, was that they were working class, so they couldn't be there all the time for us. It was They were working class. You know, so they couldn't go to every prize giving. They couldn't go to any to every choir competition just to cheer us up. I used to be in the Boy Scout movement. I would be practicing and marching for them in the kitchen, but they never really came to our contests to see for themselves. Why? Because they were working. They were expected to be at work. So notwithstanding, they were very involved in my upbringing. And so in other words, my experiences, lived experiences, observed experiences, and the teachings from my home, all combined to shape my orientation, and they even shaped some of my dreams, and therefore what happens in my life, some of it is by sheer coincidence that I find myself in sport A, at a particular time, but I will argue that. The broader path, the broader architecture of my landscape, was shaped by those experiences, and it was deliberate, intentional, and orchestrated.
So lovely. I know you went to Hilton. What was that experience like?
I went to Hilton by virtue of the scholarship I got from Shell. Otherwise, my parents will never have afforded to send me to Hilton College. I was just academically gifted. And so I was offered a scholarship to do engineering, a degree I'd never even thought of. As far as I'm concerned, my father had told me that, my boy, I can't afford to send you to university. Your elder brother is already at varsity, and we're paying for everything. So we just have limited means. We can't afford to. The issues of scholarships were and bursaries were rare. So when Shell came and said they're offering me a scholarship, first I had to go to Hilton College, and there I was. I found myself at Hilton College. Hilton was a land of, I would call a land of plenty for me. Everything was just in abundance. Food, food. Library material, laboratory equipment, and consumables was such that there's no experiment I could not do supervised. And for me it was like I was like a kid in a candy shop. But what helped me was that the school was very supportive. It truly was. When I came in January, they said, anyone here for Maths Olympiad? I raised my hand. Said, no, boy, we'll help you to prepare for that.
Sure.
Anyone for Science Olympiad? I also raised my hand. Said, both. I said, yes.
Sure.
Said, we'll support you.
Yeah.
And they gave me all the support I needed. I went to the library. I found stacks and stacks of the magazine called Archimedes, and other magazines which were critical for preparations for Science Olympiad in particular. And by the time others settled down, I was already way ahead to the extent that I became the top math student in the school. And a major accomplishment for me, because I came from a Bantu education environment. And here I was outperforming and beating my white counterparts who had been schooled in privilege all their lives.
That's amazing. And I'm asking this because if you come to think of it, during those times, at least from what we know, is that it was your conventional careers, your lawyer, doctor, become a nurse, become a that. And that was simply because most of our parents were in those fields as well. But nowhere were most black children ever thinking about mechanical engineering or whatever the case might be. And that transition then, as you get into Hilton, where you come from a different schooling system that, you know, underprivileged black people, for that matter, were subjected to. And here you are pursuing a course that's really, really, you don't find a lot of black people in there at the time. And you have to pivot in that. And then, like you said, spend some time preparing yourself, getting ahead of everyone. That transition with the school's help was something that I suppose was much easier. But did you want to always get into engineering?
To be very honest, Thapelo, I knew nothing about engineering.
Yes.
Let alone getting into it.
Yeah.
I knew nothing about engineering. But once I was invited first by Anglo-American to sit for the cadet scheme, Anglo-cadet scheme, test.
Yeah.
I then researched on engineering. And then at Vukuzakhe High School, where I was doing my high schooling, where my predecessors who had excelled in science and mathematics and who were already doing engineering. And so some people told me about, Alfred Xaba is at UCT, Cyril Gamete is at UCT. And so on. Many guys who had done very well. I said, "Oh, that's interesting. What are they? They're doing engineering." And so I learned about engineering, but at a very elementary stage, or elementary level. I just knew there's chemical engineering, there's mechanical, there's electrical, there's civil. If you are good at in physics, possibly mechanical is the best. Preferred path. If you are good in chemistry, maybe chemical engineering is. If you are good in the electrical part, maybe electrical engineering. So for me, I loved mechanical part. And so I said, I'm going to do mechanical engineering once I was asked during interviews. So I became an engineer I had to use word accident. But I would say maybe by chance. But I completed the engineering degree within the set time of 4 years. And I did I would say very, very well. But once I was in the field, I discovered that's not where I wanna be. I now have this degree. I've spent 4 years to earn it. And I've worked for 6 years as an engineer. That's 10 years. Add to that 1 year at Hilton College. That's 11 years. Am I happy? I said, no.
No.
Let me be very, honest with myself.
Yeah.
I needed to do MBA.
Yeah.
And with the intention of moving into marketing, using my engineering background. But then I actually end up in finance.
Yes, look at that. That's amazing. Now, I really don't want to bore my listeners with giving them a very extensive CV around what you have done. But if you were to summarize, and I know it's a very long journey and I'm putting you under pressure here, but if you were to summarize your career then from that 6 years, right, how was that 6 years? And then having that epiphany that says, I'm not happy here. And where did you pivot to and then take it from there?
My first 6 years as an engineer were very fulfilling.
Okay.
Insofar as giving me a sense of what industry and commerce was all about.
Yeah.
Was very fulfilling in terms of giving me a well-paying job. As an engineer, I was not paid a lot of money, but certainly I was earning well. But it was not fulfilling in terms of this, in terms of the content. And I can also say I was not the best engineer. There were much better engineers than me in the field who applied themselves better. in their job. And I said, this is not me. I'm a person who believes in excellence.
Yes.
I'm a person who believes in, you know, doing more than the minimum.
Yes.
And the 6 years was basically ticking the box and doing the minimal. And I said, now, if I carry on this path with the goals I've set for myself for the rest of my life, I'm going to soon become a very mediocre person. And I will soon get so frustrated that I don't know what else will happen in me to me. And I said, look, let me be honest with myself. Let me have a conversation with the young Zungu. And say, am I living your dream, Zungu? And the answer was no. And then I said, okay, fine. Now is the time for me to go and do an MBA. I had done some research. And I said, I will move into marketing. But once I was at varsity, at UCT Graduate School of Business, I fell in love with international finance. You know, and that actually gave me a chance to then join a merchant bank. And I found myself advising on matters of corporate finance. And then I pivoted into basically world of investment banking. And trust me, I've never looked back.
You've never looked back.
And when someone says I found my true North Star, I think, you know, in what I'm doing, I found my passion. I found my vuma. My mojo. So I'm very happy.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now, in 2000, then you started Izungu Investment Company. What brought that about? Is it now once you've worked for a merchant bank, you then pivoted and said, I can do this on my own?
Yeah, in 2000, I registered a company called Zungu Investments Company. And at the time, I'd worked for about 4 years. From 1997. To 2000, I'd worked for Saru Investments Company. 97, 8, 9, 2000. And prior to that, I had worked just for 1 year for a merchant bank, which was called DLJ Pliad. Which was a joint venture between NAIL, or in full New Africa Investments Limited, and an American investment house called Donaldson Lufkin Jenrette, DLJ. And during that 1 year, it was the most intense 1 year in my life. The most fascinating. I mean, and add to that the year I'd spent doing my MBA. I had 2 years of unrelenting adrenaline pump. I was advising on the acquisition of of Jonic by the National Empowerment Consortium. I advised on the listing of Supergroup through a cash shell called Motorlink. I pitched for many transactions. You know, unbundling proposals, disposal of assets by large conglomerates. But, you know, some were successful, in some cases were not successful. But my heart was just pumping all the time. And I said, I love this. And of course, I during the 4 years that I worked for Saru Investments, which I started from zero, from scratch, I made a lot of money for them. And I began to see wealth creation. And to be part of the wealth creation endeavors. And that's when I said, you know what? I've created so much wealth for others. And can I not do this for myself, for my own account?
Yes.
And it was then that I said, for sure.
Yeah.
And when I did that in 2002.
Yeah.
When I finally opened my the doors to my company, I'd been there, done that. I created wealth for others, and I felt I now can do it on a proprietary basis for my own family and for my own account. Yes, 2002, the doors, of Zungu Investments Company were opened, and they've never been closed ever since.
It's a very regulated industry, and you don't find quite a lot of black businesses in that particular space, right? How have you navigated the challenges of running a black investment company in a regulated, highly white industry?
I'm not the first one.
Okay.
I'm not the first one.
Hmm.
To start the company.
Hmm.
I'm not. I was not the even during the height of my the rise of Zungu Investment Company.
Yes. Yes.
There were predecessors.
Okay.
How they accomplished it is unique to every investment company.
Okay.
Regulation is not a major issue in our lives, to be very honest.
Yeah.
It's not a major issue. The major issue is how to navigate through challenges of one lack of capital.
Yeah.
Because we are dealing, someone actually put it very nicely, you're dealing with a people who want to make a lot of money in a capitalist fashion.
Yeah.
Yet they've got no capital.
Sure.
Capital is without capital.
Sure.
And how do you succeed in that environment? And for me, that's been my story. When I started Zungu Investments Company, maybe let's say when I started Saru Investments, we had zero assets, we had zero liabilities, we had zero turnover, we had zero cash in the bank. So we started on a clean slate. When I started Zungu Investments Company in 2002, when I opened the doors in 2002, I was repeating that experience that I'd had with Saru Investments 4 years earlier.
Ah.
Or maybe say 6 years earlier.
Yeah.
But how I've managed to get to here is a complex set of experiences. Some of it is about using strong networks I have in business.
Yes.
Some of it is about deploying business strategies that I've learned at business school.
Okay.
And making sure they work for me. So I mean every investment company owned by blacks has got its own unique DNA. Its own unique path.
I see.
And we can talk till cattle come home.
Yes.
There will be commonalities here and there.
Yeah.
But generally it's about what the founders have in their port of dreams.
Lovely. Okay, let's switch gears now to AmaZulu. What brought that about? What were the objectives? What were you trying to achieve? And maybe do you think you're on the right path of achieving those?
AmaZulu, so tell me,
there's
no way I can talk about AmaZulu without paying invoking those war cries,
yes.
Those praises.
Yes.
It's a very powerful brand.
It
it's
is.
A very powerful brand.
It is.
Currently, it's the oldest team.
Sure.
In the Betway Premier Soccer
yes.
League.
Yes.
We were founded in 1932.
Sure.
The next oldest team will be 5 years our junior.
Mm.
That's maybe Orlando Pirates.
Mm.
Then there will be Lamontville Golden Arrows.
Yes.
Then there will be teams like Sundowns,
yeah,
Kaizer Chiefs,
yeah,
and others are just youngsters.
Yeah.
yes. So we are a heritage team.
Yeah.
A
yeah.
heritage brand.
Yeah.
Founded with the blessings of the then reigning monarch
yes.
of the Zulu nation,
yeah.
Solomon Gadinuzul.
Yeah.
Now we were established with the blessings of the royalty.
Yes.
I'm saying all those things because it's not just a soccer team.
Yes.
It's a heritage
it's a
brand.
Heritage
it's a very
brand.
Powerful. It's a big brand.
Yeah.
And so when I'm thrust, when I'm placed in the position of leading,
yes.
position of leading this entity,
yes.
I know that it's a huge
sure.
responsibility.
It's a huge one.
Because the performance of this team, inspires.
Mm.
It's followers. It
mm.
inspires the nation,
mm.
And the underperformance
mm.
or the failure to perform
mm.
too
mm.
serves as a major source
definite.
Of disillusionment
definite.
for its supporters and
yeah.
the nation.
Yeah, sure. That's a huge responsibility, and I think that's been one that you've carried over the years with so much pride. It's so much vigor. I mean, we watch soccer, so we see you, we see how you celebrate and all those sort of stuff. So it's a huge brand, like you're saying, in South African football, and one that I think it's revered. The brand itself speaks volumes, and it's amazing to really have a conversation with someone who's leading that. So really appreciate that. Now, I want us then, Babzul, to get into the issue of money, right? Particularly looking at it from a place of you and how you relate some of the lessons that you've picked up around money and all that. But I wanna start here. If you were to characterize your relationship with money, how would you characterize it?
Money is an enabler.
Okay.
Money is not an end in itself.
Okay.
And that's how I relate with money.
Yeah.
Money is an enabler. Money is not an end in itself.
Yeah.
And money is a tool.
Yes.
Money is not a god.
Mm.
God has made money available for us to use
yes.
to achieve
yes.
Certain objectives.
Yeah.
And once you worship the money, and once you think your endowment
Eesh.
Or the blessings you have with the monetary,
yes.
They trump and they supersede
yes.
the relationships that they have with their fellow human beings,
yeah.
With your family, with your loved ones.
Mm.
Then you're in a serious problem.
Serious problem.
Because then you don't see money as an enabler.
Mm.
You now see money as some kind of a demigod.
Yes. Yes.
So that's my relationship with money. I've always seen money as what can I do with this money to deliver better. Outcome for myself, for my family, for my society, and how can I use this money to create a legacy that can last?
Mm.
So for me, I've always seen money as a tool, as a means to an end.
Yes.
What is the end? The end is to leave a legacy
yeah.
That will outlive me. by centuries, if not millennia.
Oh, lovely.
And so money is to be used in that fashion, smartly and cleverly. But at the same time, money must not be abused.
Money
is a very fickle kind of resource. Because if you abuse it, it runs away from you. If you abuse it, it shies away from people who abuse it. I'm being philosophical. There's nothing being philosophical about when you wasting your money. But for me, if you philosophical means don't abuse it. Use it wisely, save it, invest it, and leverage on it. and use it to deliver better outcomes especially for those that don't have it.
That's lovely. Now I want and thank you so much, Babu Zungu, for all of that. I think it's really, really great advice. I want to know then the one mistake that you've made with money.
Look, I know it's very difficult to say. I'm gonna search deep in my trough to find big mistakes I made with money, and there is none. There's none. I mean, I can say unequivocally. Anyone, ask anyone that knows me, whether it's my close family member. My parents are late now. Ask how much have I ever borrowed from them since I started working? And they will tell you the answer is none.
None. Oh my.
So my relationship with money has always been to say, live within your means. Don't try to be what you are not. Through other people's toiling. And so that it starts there. My relationship with accumulation of resources has been organic. And once I have it, once I'm in that space where I'm making money, I make mistakes, but I don't call them
mistakes
that are worth talking about. In other words, I do invest money, I lose money. I do invest in a business and I've done my due diligence. I've picked my partners and I think those are the right partners. I discover 3 years later that geez, what a waste of my money. But I always say it's in the nature of the business I'm in. I'll say I've
no mistake.
With every 5 rand I've made, I've possibly lost 3 rands. But the net effect is that I've gained 2 rands.
You've gained 2 rands.
Yeah. So, but along the way, if you were to do, a review of my steps. There's been a lot of wastage within that process of wealth accumulation. So I don't have a problem. I mean, I can talk about mistakes I've made choosing wrong partners. I can talk about mistakes I've made, investing without doing sufficient due diligence on the investment. I can talk about investments I've made, gearing businesses more than I should have. And when the interest rates start going up, the businesses really struggle, requiring me to put some money to get the capital structures right.
Yes.
And when I've not been able to do so, leading to great trouble.
Yeah. Yeah.
But again, it's in the nature of the business.
Mm.
I've never done this thing called I blew it. I've never blown it. I've never blown anything. And for me, it's quite critical for people to appreciate. If you're in business, you will make mistakes. And if you don't want to make mistakes, then don't be in business.
Don't be in business.
You will make mistakes. You'll lose some, but you'll also gain some.
Yeah.
But the process of winning some must be explainable.
Yeah.
Never be in a situation where you've made money. You don't know how you've made money.
Yes. Yes.
Again, when you lose money.
Yeah.
You must be able to explain it. Don't say, I don't know, I was duped.
Mm.
But you're a businessman. You should have done some studies.
Yes.
That's why when someone says, okay, invest in this business, you're going to double your money within a year. I said, no, tell that to your gogo.
Yeah.
because the best business school has told me that there's nothing like a money machine.
There's nothing like that, yes.
Yeah.
There's nothing like that. Lovely. Okay, we're drawing towards a close, Babu Zung, and I want to then go back to, as we sum it up, right, looking at if you were to advise your younger self, a younger boy, and I'm sorry to use that without sounding like I'm being disrespectful, but if you were to advise a young Sandile, for example, what would you have said to him with the benefit of hindsight?
The one thing that I'll say to the Sandile, the boy,
yes,
is my boy, focus.
Focus.
My boy, be patient. Things take time. You plant, you want to grow an oak tree. You want to plant it, it will not be appearing above the ground anytime soon. Just believe in the process.
Believe in the
soil that you've planted it. Believe in watering. When it comes up and you protect it, you've got a tree for 100 years. Believe in the process.
Yes.
Be focused. Don't be here, there, and everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And be patient. Be patient. Don't starve yourself whilst you are being patient.
Mm-hmm.
But adopt a philosophy that says I'm patient.
Yes.
And work hard. And don't take shortcuts.
Don't take
shortcuts. And if you work hard, no one is going to put you down.
Yes.
They will try.
Yes.
But the old adage, you can't put a good man down.
Yeah, you can't.
Will come in very handy. So work hard, be focused, don't take shortcuts.
Yeah.
Be patient.
Yeah,
those are the simple. There's a simple set of advice I'll give to the young Sandile.
Lovely, Ubaba has done so many things. I mean, you've achieved quite a bit, and one would look at you and say, but what else is still there for you to do? Where do you see 10 years from now? Are there still things that you still want to pursue?
There are many things.
Yeah.
Honestly, many things. Right now, I will say 90% of my wealth, derives from South Africa.
Yes.
In other words, I've got 90% of my eggs in one basket.
Okay, I see.
And anyone will tell you that's not prudent.
Yes.
In as much as I'm a South African bull, I believe in the future of South Africa. I'll be the last person to jump out of the ship when it's sinking. All of you will have jumped out. I so believe in this country. But it's still not wise to keep all your eggs in one basket. So the process of diversifying in terms of geography, away from South Africa, into the rest of the continent, into the globe, is a process that I'm very excited about, and which I've embarked on, I've begun to embark on, and that keeps me excited about what lies ahead. And I think, you know, raising my kids. Fun enough, I mean, of all the blessings that God has given me, the biggest and the best blessing are my children. Is my family. You know, and raising them. Investing in them. Is just as important as investing. In diversification of Zulu Investments Company. So whilst I'm doing all these, you know, call it investments, I'm also nurturing and growing young men and women. And I love it. So my objectives are multiple, and certainly I enjoy every step of it.
Ah, lovely, lovely. As we end on this one, I am born as Sotho, but I did isiZulu, so isiZulu soqobo was very much my reference point in everything that I did for my high school until I did my matric, and I did it in higher grade. So please correct me, Baba, but if I'm not wrong, abagwa zungu abagwa emanzini
impela ozungu omanzini
omanzini ogwabi
onyamakayishi ohamash onqona nkoma etemahiyeni omhlahla omnyama abangani abasinda bahlala.
I'm sure this is some man from the school, and I was listening in class. So, Nzwega.
You're listening.
I was listening in class.
Indeed, Manzini. But when this is a telenovela called Sibaya came up, then the most prominent clan name became Usengwa.
So what would be your last words then, kubalaleli bethu?
The last word for me is, look, first of all, to appreciate the invite.
Thank you so much.
To be on this wonderful platform and to talk to to share my perspective with your listeners.
Yes, thank you so much.
My last word will be, you know, in building our nation, in catapulting our nation to a trajectory which is better than where it is now, will require all of us to play our part. And including working hard, including protecting the assets that we have, including ensuring that we prioritize on investing and making money work for us, then engaging on what is generally called conspicuous consumption. Where we behave like the nouveau riche who display, who flaunt the recent gains. So when people invest their resources for longevity, then I love it, and I wish your listeners well in terms of planning for the future.
Thank you so much, Baba. Siyabonga kakhulu, inkosi ikubusise. Thank you so much. Of course, that was our elder there, Ubaba Usandile Zungu, talking to us. This is our shapeshifter for today, and what a beautiful blessed life. I hope you're encouraged.
Do you want to make your money make sense? Listen to Business Sense every Monday to Thursday, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. and make sense of your money.